Right. Always good to have all of you with us. We are in Mark chapter 14, the longest chapter of Mark. And we are going to start in verse number 27. Verse number 27. And we'll start with looking at verses 27 through 31, and we'll start looking at that. Yeah, so there we go. There is the word cloud for Mark chapter 14, and we are moving to another section, so another section of Mark here. So we're in this area of the suffering servant that we see in the box right now, or we were. And it ended in sacrifice that we see in the Last Supper here. And now we're moving on to this next one that's called Betrayed and Killed. Betrayed and Killed. Now I recognize that might be difficult for many of you to see, so I blew it up. Looking at this, we can see that there are lots of things in this particular section. Judas betrays Jesus. We already talked about that a little bit when he goes to get the money. He makes a deal with the Jewish leaders, and he carries it through in this next section. The disciples run, we see, and that's going to be predicted here in this next couple of verses. We see that Peter denies Christ three times. Again, that is predicted in these next few verses, and it's going to and it correlates. We have this here with the circle and the three arrows. Those three arrows point to the different times that Jesus predicted his death, predicted certain things, and so we and of course Peter affirms all of that, or at least denies a lot of that here in those sections too, where he says, "No, this isn't going to happen," and Jesus says, "No, it's going to happen." The Jews end up accusing Jesus of all sorts of things, and the Romans eventually execute him. So that's all covered in this section. That finishes out chapter 14 and all of chapter 15. So this is the betrayal, the trial, and the execution of Jesus. All right, and this continues on Thursday evening. And so this is Peter's denial being prophesied. And so that's again chapter 14, verses 27 through 31. So let's go ahead and read this section. Then Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter said to him, "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." Jesus said to him, "Now, yet I will not be, excuse me." But Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But he spoke more vehemently, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said likewise. They all said likewise. So we're going to consider the prediction here, the prediction that has being made. Jesus here predicts that his disciples, the remaining 11, because of course Judas has already left by this point to do all the betraying, would deny Christ. And further, this further proves that he was not afraid of making predictions. You know, he is Jesus. He's making all these predictions that we see throughout the Gospel of Mark and a lot of other gospel accounts. We see he's making these predictions. He even cites a passage proving what he was saying, and he cites Zechariah chapter 13 and verse 7. Of course, the latter half of Zechariah is full of prophecies concerning Jesus, as Jesus cites it several times in the events surrounding his death and resurrection. And you know, we talked about at least one of those, and I think there's one more coming up. Zechariah foretells of this particular event in that particular passage in Zechariah 13:7, saying, "Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered." That's what it reads when we look at it in Zechariah. When we look at that again in Zechariah, it is in the imperative, meaning that it is a it seems like it is some kind of a command from God. But Jesus quotes it as something the speaker would do, a first person singular. I will strike the shepherd. So in Zechariah, it is not a command per se. It's not saying definitely strike the shepherd. It is a sort of a conditional. And you so if you strike the shepherd, even though if is not particularly in that phrase, if the shepherd is struck, then the sheep will be scattered. Kind of like saying, I'm gonna make a Star Wars reference. Strike me down and I shall become more powerful than you could possibly imagine, right? That's he's not inviting the fact that he wants to be struck down. He is saying that he is that if this happens, then you will then I will become more powerful. And so that's the kind of idea that we see here in Zechariah. And we see that that is the case and is going to be fulfilled here in the next few moments. So Jesus here lets us know that God has a role in striking Jesus down. I will strike the shepherd. After all, he is the one to pay for our sins and our iniquities as God exercises his wrath on Jesus on our account. The sheep, meaning the disciples, would be scattered and they would stumble about, not having anyone to guide or direct them. So, one question I have here, and it's kind of early on, why do you suppose that Jesus would tell them about this? You know, he knows all and he is very particular about what he reveals. So why would he reveal this to the disciples? You know, it's an unpleasant thought. Why would I reveal this to them? Why would I go through with this? Why reveal this particularly unpleasant thought? Is it simply to further prove his abilities or to show off his understanding of scripture that we see within Zechariah? Or is there a deeper meaning? Sam, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think there might be some kind of deeper meaning here?
Well, I think there's a purpose, and I think in all the situations where Jesus is talking about his crucifixion and all those things, he's preparing them. You can imagine how shocking it was for them, and we see, you know, because they weren't expecting the mob to come here in just a few minutes, right? In just an hour or two. They weren't expecting the crucifixion. They weren't expecting any of that. And I think every time that he's doing this, even throughout his ministry, like you said, when we studied earlier, where he'd say things about his crucifixion, they're just going like, okay, this has to be some sort of metaphorical reference because surely he's not gonna be killed. I think he's preparing them, and I think he's kind of amping it up here as he gets closer and closer to the event. So, you know, they're gonna have they're, one, they won't be as shocked, and even though they're obviously shocked. And that he's preparing them mentally for the probably the most trying thing in their whole life.
I tend to concur with that. And you know, I think it's better to know that your future failure is expected. But Jesus knows about it. Jesus knows that, hey, you have been chosen. He still chose you for this particular task, even though you're going to fail in this particular instance. It would no doubt be an encouragement later when Peter and the disciples remember that Jesus said this very thing. And had Jesus mentioned it earlier, it might have discouraged them. Earlier than this point, it might have discouraged them from being his disciples in the first place. So this is the time to mention it because it would be a discouragement earlier, or if he mentioned it, or if he didn't mention it at all, then it might discourage them later. Like, I'm a failure. What, how can I possibly follow Jesus? No, Jesus expected it, and yet he still chose you.
I think you're onto something here. So there's an aspect, I mean, it's kind of a weird way to comfort somebody, but there is an aspect of strengthening them by saying, look, this is going to happen. And when it does happen, you know, it's like it says several times later, you know, and then they realized, right? It says in John as well, you know, and then they remembered, and that he's preparing them to deal with, you know, the situation of their own failure and denial and running away, right? And abandoning him, that they might not have been able to bear it otherwise. You know, Judas went off and hung himself. You know, he was so distraught. So he's giving them comfort and really preparing them in a way. It's kind of a strange way, but of course he knows exactly what he's doing.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, we have to assume that he knows exactly what he's doing. and so it's our responsibility, if the reason for it isn't specifically stated, it's our responsibility to figure out what that is, if we want to know why. And I think that's a good reason. And it makes sense that he expects this sort of failure to happen. And yet it encourages them. And you're right, that's kind of a strange way to encourage, but it does in the long run. Then Jesus predicts something here, that after his resurrection, he will join them in Galilee. You know, this is quite interesting, as he is treating his resurrection as a foregone conclusion. But after I have been raised, you know, it's going to happen. It's a foregone conclusion. And telling them what's going to happen after his death, of all things. You know, he also presumes that after the disciples scatter, they will all return home to Galilee. And in fact, we do read about that. Recall, Jesus had called Peter, Andrew, James, and John as they were tending their nets as fishermen on the Sea of Galilee, especially James and John were tending their nets. Matthew, he met up with later. Not far from that position, not far from where he met with those four. They would all eventually go home, and we find many of them resuming their old vocation. We find especially in John chapter 21. And he would indeed meet them later in Galilee, where he gives the Great Commission. We read about that. We can see that. We typically don't read in the Great Commission, Matthew 28, verse 16, but it indicates that they were in Galilee when the Great Commission was given, or at least when it was recorded there in Matthew 28. So that is, again, he goes to Galilee and says he's going to go there. All right, so now we're going to look at the rebuttal here of what Peter says in this particular case. You know, brash Peter, you know, he says this phrase, even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be. You know, and my question, how would you describe that attitude? That attitude that Peter has? I have a comment here on this. But I want to hear what you think before. But Dan has a comment, and probably with reference to what we've been talking about earlier. Once they realize their failure came to be, they may have been more receptive to Jesus' claim that he will be resurrected. Perhaps so too. You know, saying, "Oh yeah, I was absolutely convinced that this particular thing wasn't going to happen. Maybe the other things he said was going to happen." Are going to happen. So that's a good point, Dan. Thank you. So, Sam, or anybody else would like to comment. How do you feel? What do you think how would you describe, let's put it that way, how would you describe Peter's attitude here?
Well, he's obviously very confident in his belief and loyalty to Jesus, right? But I think, as happens with all of us in a lot of situations, until we've actually met the reality of a challenge, we can't really predict our response. And you know, so he's looking at this and saying, well, you know, no matter what happens, I'm going to stand by you. I'm going to always be there, even if I have to die. There's a lot of people who've said that over the years in all kinds of situations. And when it comes down to it, when the reality of it hits them, you know, they're unable to deliver on their promise. And so I think some of this is just natural, you know, confidence in himself. And, you know, he's always, like you said, he's brash. So, you know, one aspect of brashness is extreme self-confidence that you know yourself, you know, you're right. You know, your weaknesses, you've got it all locked. And he obviously doesn't, but I think mostly it's drawn out of his love and devotion to Jesus.
Yeah, at least he thinks he knows himself very well. you know, I describe it as, and you said confidence and whatnot. Perhaps there's an element of pride here. He gets defensive and prideful. You know, they may do that, but I'm not going to do that. In fact, he was just told earlier at supper that one of them would betray Jesus, as if being scattered was less believable. Perhaps it was more, it was the more general way in which Jesus presented this, that all of them would stumble as opposed to just one betraying him. But Peter, being the brash one, the spokesman often of the disciples, and one of the closest disciples, as we'll see in a moment, says this won't happen to him. This won't happen to me. Have we ever said anything like that before? Are we ever like that? Do we ever get so prideful to say that we would never fall for, you know, we might say, oh, you know, that'll never happen to me. That's other people. do we ever get so prideful that we say that we'd never fall for something or a particular sin? Are we ever like that? No, man, that happens to other people. That doesn't happen to me. How often do we fall for it? It reminds me in Luke 18 of the Pharisee and the tax collector going up to pray. Right? Do you remember that story where Jesus, you know, it's unknown if this was an actual event or if Jesus is telling them of sort of a, in a, almost a parable format, where he says, a Pharisee did this. He said, I am so glad I am not like this sinner. I'm not going to fall for these sins. I'm so glad I'm not like that. And what does the tax collector say? Forgive me, for I am a sinner. Who went home justified? Was it the Pharisee or the tax collector? This reminds me of that level of pride, of that level of arrogance that one might have. You know, you're no better than they are. Just as Peter was no better than the other disciples. We need to be on guard constantly, vigilant against the sin that might creep up in the world, in our lives. You know, Renee says yes, and I think that's the answer to the question, do we ever get prideful? Are we ever like that? Yeah, we are. I know there are certain sins I thought I'd never fall for, and yet. So we need to make sure that we are, again, ever vigilant to make sure that we keep ourselves free of sin. All right. The next one here, the rooster crows. Well, it says the rooster's crows I have here on my notes. You know, you think you won't stumble. No, it's worse. You're going to deny me, Jesus says, essentially. That's the Stephen Hughes paraphrase, if you will. And no, you think you won't stumble? No, it's worse. You're going to deny me. Sam, do you have something? No? Okay, I thought I heard some. All right. Renee says, in verse 37, he said, oh. Hold on a second. Sam got disconnected. All right, there you are. All right, so Renee says in verse 37, he says, watch to not stumble into temptation. Maybe The crowing is the need for awareness and shame. Ah, yeah. Well, we'll get into that in a little while. Yeah, that's an interesting point, interesting way to look at that. So not only are you going to stumble, no, it's worse. You're going to deny me this very night. Evening had come, of course, before supper. We see in chapter 14 and verse 17. So they were well into the night by this point. And Jesus gives a sign as to when these denials were going to take place before the rooster crows twice. Twice. In the other gospel accounts, it only mentions one of the rooster's crows. You know, I have found, of course, conflicting information about when out there on when the rooster crows. You know, a lot of people have different opinions on that. And no wonder. I mean, it's an animal that can be somewhat unpredictable. I mean, so, you know, there are a lot of different ideas on that. Of course, we all know that the primary time of day, or the one that we often think of whenever the rooster crows, is just before dawn, you know, waking up. Usually, the farmers and everybody else around them, in order to get them started for the day. This is the second one. This second one, the one that Jesus is talking about in the other accounts. The second one, the one people typically think of, is the one that will occur when Jesus, well, right before. Peter denies him. So right before dawn occurs, he says, "You're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows." especially since in each account, the very thing that happens is morning. As that morning has come. So we find in verse 72, you know, the second time the rooster crows. And then Peter remembers, oh, yeah, you're going to deny me. And then immediately in the morning in chapter 15 and verse 1. So we see that it does, you know, it is right before dawn. The earlier one, the second one that Jesus references here only in Mark, is said to occur sometime after midnight. And I heard conflicting. This is where it's conflicting. Is it between midnight and 1? Is it around 3 o'clock? You know, what time is it? That doesn't matter, really. It's just sometime after midnight. And so that's what I have here. Sometime after midnight, the rooster crows this first time. But since most people are in a deep sleep by this point, we pay little mind to it. We don't really pay attention to that. But since they all were going to be awake during this time, for the most part, then Jesus says, hey, this is going to happen. And you'll hear that first one, and that'll be a warning to you, as Renee just said here. But we'll get into that later when we get to the the actual denials. Of course, Jesus, his disciples, and the kangaroo court that were called were awake and eager to try Jesus, as we'll see. And we'll talk more about that when we get there. Again, why do you think Jesus would reveal this to Peter and the others? Is it for the same reasons as before, or is it something else? Do you think there's some other reason why Jesus might reveal this specifically to Peter? Sam, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, Peter does the explicit denials, and of course, they're recorded in the Gospels. And the others run away, right? So Peter's hanging around, and John's still there. If you're reading John's there watching the trial. And in fact, he's the reason that Peter gets to come in. And so Peter is going through this really crazy roller coaster of emotions, right? He's ready to die with Jesus in one instance. Then he, you know, he pulls out the sword and whacks the servant's ear in the garden and you know, and then puts it away, and then they take him, and then everyone runs away, and then he goes to see the trial, and then he denies them, you know, three times. And Jesus, I think, is strengthening Peter, you know, getting him prepared for what's going to happen, you know, that Peter will make it through. And I think Jesus knows, of course, what's going to happen, and he knows Peter's heart. And he wants to make sure that Peter's prepared for the trial he's going to go through.
Yeah, good point. And I think I, you know, and I've got that on here as well. So, you know, if there's another reason for Jesus specifically mentioning this for to Peter, you know, perhaps it's to humble him. You know, I mentioned that he was prideful earlier in his boast. Perhaps this is to humble him and to let him know he's not all that he thinks he is. And you know what? That's okay. That's okay. You know, we all stumble from time to time. We just need to remember to get back up. You know, somebody reminded me of a proverb the other day, and I can't remember the exact reference. You might be able to look it up from the quotation or the references that I mentioned, where a righteous man will fall seven times, but then he gets back up. But the wicked will fall in the day of calamity. And so that idea is, you know, he is righteous. Peter's a righteous man. He denies Jesus three times eventually. But, you know, at this point, he hasn't done any of that. So he's a righteous man. He might be prideful. He might be a little bit arrogant in his presumption here. But we have to remember, he has to remember he needs to get back up. To get back up, and he does get back up. We find a little bit later on. Renee says, "Agreed. Doubting is a strong characteristic for us too." And I think she might be referring to Sam's comments. How real is Jesus to each of us? She says, "Great point, Sam." So yeah, and so that's, you know, that's a good comment there. So how real is he? It's hard to say. It's hard to say. All right. So then we see a vehement rebuttal, and there's a rebuttal at first, and then he says, "But he spoke more vehemently." Sam says it was Proverbs 24:16 that I had referenced earlier, but I didn't quite remember the exact reference. So thank you, Sam. Appreciate that. So he spoke more vehemently. So this is a more vehement rebuttal. It's more strong. He says, or more strong, it's stronger. He's saying, "Hey, no, this isn't going to happen. If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said likewise. They all went along with this particular rebuttal here. You know, Peter doubles down, vehemently disregarding Peter's words. Vehemently, or rather Jesus' words. Peter is vehemently disregarding Jesus' words. Boy, you know, the scripture has a way of holding a mirror up to you, doesn't it? How many times do we vehemently deny what he's telling us in the scriptures? He's saying, "I heard you, Jesus, but man, I have to disagree. You're wrong." What? Wow. To tell Jesus that he is wrong? Peter certainly earns his reputation as being brash, doesn't he? He even goes so far as to say that he would be willing to die for Jesus. Man, be careful what you say. And what's more amazing is that they all joined in on this rebuttal and saying, "Hey, no, you know, Jesus, you're wrong." All 11 of them said that. Even after Jesus told them point blank that they would all scatter. Instead of taking Jesus's lead, they take Peter's. And we find that Jesus doesn't react to this, or at least it's not recorded that he did react to it. It's as if Jesus is saying, "We'll see. They mean well, but we'll see." And that's the kind of attitude I think we should have sometimes. You know, whenever we predict something we are pretty sure is going to happen, We'll see. We'll see about that. We don't have to continue arguing the point. We just have to say we'll see. And then at the end, whenever it does happen, should we say, huh, told you so? No, not necessarily. I don't see Jesus saying told you so. And so that's something important to consider as well. And we find Sam mentioned when Peter's going to slash the ear off of one of the guards in a few moments in our reading here, that at that point he's willing to go through with the words that he just spoke here. He's willing to die for Jesus. So he's not lying. But it doesn't, it's not a very robust event here. Because once he's in custody, what does Peter do? Well, we'll find out, certainly. All right. So we got about 10 minutes or so left. We'll at least read the next section and see how far we can get. So that's verses 32 through 42, the prayer in Gethsemane. I hate that we have to break this up, but I think I think it'll be all right. Then Jesus came to a place which was named Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took Peter, James, and John with him, and he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch." He went a little farther and fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will." I'm not sure we're going to get much past that point, so I'll stop reading there, and we can read it in its fullness next week. Though Renee adds, a conclusion may also be the need for meekness for Peter. He was humble here. This is a personal lesson to Peter. Yeah, Jesus was humble here. That's right. Jesus was humble here, and again, another personal lesson. That's good. That's a good point. All right. So in the garden, of course, we know that this is the Garden of Gethsemane. Doesn't say that this is a garden specifically, at least in this in what we've read just now. But we know that this is the Garden of Gethsemane. Gethsemane is Aramaic. Let's see, Gethsemane is Aramaic for olive press. For olive press, which is an indication that this was a grove of olive trees at the base of the Mount of Olives. And boy, that makes sense, doesn't it? So when the Bible says they go out to the Mount of Olives, and the next time we see them in this garden, that's why. We see that in the passages that we just saw. All right, so it was nice, quiet, and dark, while still being somewhat illuminated by the city lights. An ideal place to sit and pray by the temple. It was also ideal for the guards to come and arrest him. There is an indication in Luke's account that this was a place that this was a place that Jesus and his disciples often came to pray. Judas had been here many times as well with them and knew just where to look for Jesus. Jesus, instead of running from his duty, from his responsibilities, he came here anyway and allowed himself to be caught despite his ardent pleas toward God. And so for the location of this, we see on here the temple. This is a modern representation of a modern map of this. So, of course, this isn't what it looks like today, but this is where the Temple Mount is located. The borders of the city here in orange, and the Mount of Olives here in blue, and the Garden of Gethsemane is there in is right there in red. So that's Gethsemane right there. And this is what Gethsemane looks like today, a picture of somebody who took who went to the Mount of Olives or went to the Garden of Gethsemane. And can you imagine such an idyllic place to sit and pray? Now, I don't know if this is exactly what it looked like, but this is one of the pictures that we can see and we can imagine that maybe it looks something like this while he was there. Just praying underneath one of those trees, very quiet, very dark, no distractions. I even have a map here of where of this particular thing. So we find here in this particular one, we see Jerusalem here, and we sort of just saw that in the map. This particular video has the upper room. That's kind of where people think it was located. Of course, we don't know exactly where it was located, but that's the traditional location for it over there on the western part of the city. And the top of the Mount of Olives is there as well. We see also the Gethsemane, the Garden of Gethsemane there at the base of the Mount of Olives. And then we see, zoomed in a little bit more, the Kidron Valley and, again, the Temple Mount and Gethsemane there. So they go down through the Kidron Valley and then go to Gethsemane to pray. All right. So, again, this is Gethsemane, just such an idyllic place to pray. And no surprise that he would go there often to do this. We find the disciples. That's the next little point here in the next few verses. What they do. The disciples, he took Peter, James, and John with him. What does he do with the other disciples? Well, as they approach this garden, Jesus asks 8 of the remaining 11 to stay behind, perhaps near the entrance of the garden. Then he takes what I call the inner circle with him, Peter, James, and John, to go a little farther. This is the third time recorded in Mark that these three go with him while the others remain behind. Now, the first was when he raises Jairus' daughter in chapter 5 and verse 37. The second was to witness the transfiguration in chapter 9 in verse 2. Jesus expresses his deep sorrow with this time. He says, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. It's as if he's saying, I'm so sad that it's killing me. So sad that, that it's killing me. Then he asks his closest friends to keep watch with him. This is not unlike the command that he gave at an earlier moment on the Mount of Olives toward the end of the Olivet Discourse in Mark chapter 13 and verse 37. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch, watch. This is a moment of great need that our Lord had. And we'll find these three are just not up to the task. Man, have you ever been in great need before and there was no one there to help you? Have you been asked to help someone who was in great need and you weren't able to help or you didn't help? That is tough. That is tough. And that's what Jesus is going through right now. This is the hour in which he is in the most need, his most distressing hour. And yet the disciples just aren't up to the task. Let's consider the prayer that that is made here. This prayer, Jesus says, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. You know, it says that he goes a little bit farther. And Luke says he goes a stone's throw from the three, from Peter, James, and John. And he fell down and he prayed. It was within eyeshot. They could see him. Peter, Andrew, or Peter, James, and John could see Jesus, but it's barely within earshot, depending on how loud Jesus is speaking or anyone is speaking in this olive grove. Jesus knew that what he was about to endure. And as we said a moment ago, he let himself be caught. But that didn't mean that he wasn't struggling with it. Have you ever known you were about to face something you weren't going to enjoy, but you knew it was necessary? This is by far an understated comparison, but it's kind of like ripping off the band-aid. In fact, it's almost become a phrase for many of us. Just rip that band-aid off. We're not literally talking about a band-aid, but it's something uncomfortable for us. Something uncomfortable for us, and we are about to experience that. Renee says, cup meaning life. I believe, not that he was refusing in any way the suffering to come. So the cup would be, let's see. I don't think I mentioned the cup specifically in my notes here, but the cup is essentially the suffering that he's going to experience. Take this cup, take this suffering away from me. It's what's going to happen, this lot in life, if you will. I'm not ready for that. And we see that in a little bit in what Paul says in 2 Timothy 4, where he says that he's being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of his departure is at hand. So it's kind of a reference to the idea that he's talking about the suffering he was about to endure. The idea is that doing it all at once, right? Doing all the ripping off a band-aid at once, right? It may hurt, but it won't be as prolonged as taking it off slowly. It's got to come off. But just before doing it, you are dreading it, despite knowing that it's better in the long run. Of course, dying on the cross is exponentially worse than ripping off a band-aid. But I think the concept is similar. It's better to take care of it now than prolonging the suffering. That doesn't mean he doesn't want to go through it. His earthly flesh is warring with his sense of duty and purpose. And I'll end with this quote from Brother Wayne Jones, and he words it like this: "There is no doubt that Jesus was engaged in a spiritual battle, wherein the internal conflict of the flesh, seeking to avoid the extreme pain of the cross, was in conflict with the mission of the Messiah to come and do the will of the Father." His prayer was an expression that this battle had and exhibited a strong desire to settle the matter once for all. How many times have we talked about the purpose statements of Jesus and the fact that he was meant to give his life a ransom for many? We see in chapter 10 and verse 45. This is the thematic verse of Mark's gospel. Chapter 10, verse 45. And it is on display here. He knows what he has to do, but he's scared. Can you blame him? Sam, any final thoughts before we end this stream?
Just a couple. One of the things that we tend to forget is crucifixions were public events. The people who were crucified were on the road, in the city. I mean, people saw them. Everybody had probably, by this time, every adult had seen somebody being crucified or dead hanging on a cross. It was really obvious the kind of stuff he was going to have to go through. And so, he had all of those memories and all of those thoughts to struggle with as well. And of course, the humanity of Jesus is the thing being displayed here, right? If he was, "Oh, well, I know I'm going to be raised. It's no big deal. I'm the Son of God," that would not have been the person to be our substitute, right? To be there for us, because he wouldn't have had to struggle with what we struggle with. But as we'll see when we get further, when Jesus comes, you know, before the mob comes, he's resolute. You know, he has come to his decision and he's going to go through with it and nothing's going to stop him.
Yeah. He's, you know, to the attitude that Jesus expresses here is a human thing to do. It's human to want to avoid that kind of pain and suffering. So we can identify with that. We can understand that, not perhaps to the extent of suffering on a cross, but we do want to avoid pain if we can get away with it. But in any event, thank you all for your comments, Renee, Dan, and Sam, of course. Thank you all so much. We'll have our worship live stream in just a moment. Please join us for that as we close this live stream out. God bless you. See you in a second.